Forgotten Classics, where a good story never goes out of style.
Hello, everybody. I'm Julie, and here we are with episode 24 of Forgotten Classics, continuing with China Court by Rumor Godden. As everybody may have noticed, I never caught up with that lost week. Work has continued to be insane, although it's finally slowing down now, just in time for me to take off for Thanksgiving. So we probably never will get that lost week back, so we're just going to let it go. Now, it is Thanksgiving here in the United States, the Thursday when we all take off, eat a lot of turkey, and then, of course, watch football. Because that's the all-American way, right? And I sound as if I'm making fun of it, but no, I'm a Cowboys fan. I'm going to watch the Cowboys. Hannah is coming home from A&M. I'm really looking forward to that. So we'll have her with us for a few days. And today is Wednesday, so I'm getting ready to make pumpkin pie, pecan pie, as many side dishes as will be gracefully reheated later, and I'll put a link to what I'm making in my cooking blog. In the meantime, I have been thinking about this new genre of, or maybe it's a subgenre of, maybe you would call it the fantasy genre in general, which is superhero fiction. It has come out of the comic books, and we know, gone into the movies, but now come out of the movies, and people are writing books about superheroes. And it's kind of funny to see all the different takes on it. Brave Men Run is a Patio Books book that I really enjoy, that I encourage you listening to. That one is due to tampering with people, even though he never calls it superheroes. That's what they are, basically. Mer Lafferty has just started a superhero book on Patio Books also, and she makes it clear up front this is due to government tampering with DNA to try to improve people. Unfortunately, they also got some villains out of the mix, so that's not always a good thing. As we know, these are often cautionary tales underneath all the fun. Then you have, you know, it's like the comic books. You have the ones that are caused by accidents in the laboratory. There's a series going based on that called Feedback, A Hero's Story, I think is the name of it. I have a whole list of these. Of course, I left them at work and I'm doing this at home, so I will put links to all these. But I just think it's very interesting that all of a sudden I could name five or six of these things if I'm sitting down and thinking about it, that all are about superheroes. They all kind of deal with it differently. And I guess what made me think of it first is Steve Ely talking about it on Escape Pod, where they have an occasional series by one author called Union Dues. And it's about superheroes that are having trouble with their superhero union. Is the union out for their good or out for some other purpose that they don't understand? How do they deal with it individually? So he doesn't worry about where the superheroes came from. The podcast I'm going to recommend also has to do with superheroes, and it is chapters of a book called The Secret World Chronicle. It's by two authors who I never read individually. I've tried them, and they just didn't grab me. But together, I love this series by Mercedes Lackey and Steve Libby. They're fun. It's kind of thoughtful. It's basically super villains start attacking the United States. This loose confederation of superheroes comes together in order to fight them. Each chapter is told from a different superhero's point of view, and it's very interesting. They're all so different. I really, really like it. I guess now they've just gone on to Patio Books, the first book has, but they also have their own website, and that's where I discovered them, where they're on to book two, which is the aftermath of these attacks and how it's being dealt with. So I found the first chapter or two rather confusing, but if you stick with it past all that, it all makes sense pretty quickly. They also don't worry about where the superheroes came from necessarily. They're just talking about the conflict they're in and how each of the individuals is responding depending on their nature and the situation. And that's what makes it interesting, because it's very character-driven. Also, their heroes and villains are really fascinating in the different kinds of powers they have. So that's kind of interesting, too. So do give that a listen if you're interested at all in this. And as I said, I'll have a list of different ones that you can try. Going on to China Court, one of the reasons this is a little later than I would have liked, I only did the first part of Lauds, as you may recall, last time, and the last part actually was fairly short. I didn't realize that until I started to read it, so I had to wait till I got time to do the second chapter, or section, which is called Prime, and I thought that I would talk a little bit about what does it mean to pray the hours of the day, because this book is organized by those sections that one would use praying the hours. I suppose other disciplines have it, but it's an essentially Catholic thing, at least at this point. It's basically helpful to Christians to remember God by praying at regular hours of the day. And this is taken from Jewish custom long ago when the first Christians, a lot of them were Jews, of course, and they had the custom of reciting prayers at certain hours of the day and or night. So that was adapted, and as time has gone by, of course, it has continued to grow and develop. And you'll find different contemplative orders of religious do it as a matter of course. In fact, Godden's book, In This House of Breed, those nuns do that, and that's discussed some here and there as it's scattered around. And of course, as the faithful do this, it's very helpful to have a book to guide you through it, kind of give you something else to focus on so you're not left just on your own. So that's the description that's in the beginning of each section of the book, is from the book that Mrs. Quinn uses to recite the hours of the day. The next section in Prime discusses the hours a little bit more also, so that kind of helps describe it too. The different sections are Lauds, which is when you wake up, Prime, when you get out of bed, Terce, that's mid-morning, Sext is at noon, Nuns, mid-afternoon, Vespers is early evening, Compline is bedtime, and Matins is, they say, when sleep is difficult, and if you're in a contemplative order or really, really serious about it, and I don't know many lay people who would do this, but I guess if you had a special devotion or a special reason to offer a sacrifice of prayer, then you would get up a couple times during the night, I think, and do this, or at the night and very early in the morning and do this. The link that I'm going to leave not only has a brief description of this with a very simple prayer that you could say, but it also has a link to the history. And it can get very complicated, all kinds of readings and lots of prayers, but I like this idea that is in this link that I show, which is very simple. I think that's probably how Mrs. Quinn's book is ordered also. So we will go on and have the conclusion of Lauds and the entirety of Prime, which is relatively short, and I will meet you on the other side. China Court by Rumor Godden. This book is under copyright and is being read with permission of the author's trust and of her agents. For more information, see the links at this podcast blog. Lauds, continuation.
"What be ye going to do now?" Mrs. Abel asked Cecily. "Make cakes."
And presently through the house crept the warmth and living smell of baking, of Cecily's drop scones, of yeast in a bowl set in the fender with a cloth over it for the yeast to prove, and presently a smell of hot fruit bread and pungent of saffron cake.
"They'll expect that," said Cecily, "saffron cake and clotted cream. They don't have time to make homemade things, poor souls."
"Will 'em all come?" asked Mrs. Abel as she and Cecily were drinking tea at the kitchen table.
Cecily nodded, but the nod was short.
"If Miss Bella and Mr. Walter takes over the house, I suppose you'd be staying," said Mrs. Abel for mischief.
"Not for all the tea in China," said Cecily.
"Bella's all right," she added. "Her bark's worse than her bite. But Mr. Walter..."
Then Cecily's face hardened, which was the only way she could contain her grief.
"The house won't be taken over. It will be sold."
"Not for all the tea in China.
is one of Cecily's favorite expressions, and it is odd that she should use it, for it is, in a way, the tea in China that builds China Court. Great Uncle MacLeod,
who began it all,
says Mrs. Quinn, makes a fortune in the China tea run, and though Eustace is only his nephew, the St. Probus quarry is bought for him. It amuses MacLeod to buy property in the village where he began. He buys land as well, and builds China Court as a wedding present for Eustace and Adza. The portrait over the fireplace in the hall is of Great Uncle MacLeod.
Your great, 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 great uncle, Mrs. Quinn tells Tracy.
There has always been a rumor in the village that he has gypsy blood, and this, with the gossip that he is in reality Eustace's father, might explain the magnificent and unexpected darkness of the two youngest of Eustace's brood, Jared and Damaris, though they do not look gypsy, but as if there were a strain, from some sailor perhaps, darker than Cornish, a Venetian or Spaniard. It is only a rumor, and certainly the middle-aged man in the portrait is very much an Englishman, portly with pale brown hair, paler blue eyes, a long nose, and such a floridly red complexion that Mrs. Quinn's irreverent children call the portrait the prawn. The watercolors on the stairs are Great Uncle MacLeod's too, his clippers, the foundling, and the Mary Bazan.
His wife was Mary Bazan, and he was a foundling in this village, Mrs. Quinn tells Tracy. That was why he took the name Quinn.
The village is full of Quinns, to Eliza's chagrin. The house is not named for the tea clippers, nor for the collection of Famille Rose porcelain, reputed to be authentic, sent home by MacLeod II when he goes out to his great uncle's business in Canton when it has settled down again after the Opium War. Though these reasons for China Court's name are invariably given by the village, it is from neither of them, but from the more mundane fact that the day the roof goes on, with beer for the workmen and a green bough in a chimney, is also the day Eustace, following in his uncle's footsteps in making money, buys over the China clay works at Canverisk.
Better call it China House, he says,
but to Adza, his little bride, plump even then as a pigeon and as simple as a bud, the house is more impressive than any she has ever imagined, and not China House, China Court, says Adza. It has a courtyard, where the kitchen and nursery wing makes an L, but the house is decidedly not a court. It is middle-sized and middle-class, says Eliza. But the name suits a house built on the edge of the Cornish moors that have a strange foreign flavor as they roll to the skyline, with their towers and the pale-colored Chinese coolie hat shapes of the sand dumps at the different China clay works breaking the dark landscape. Stannin, Hawkstor, Temple, and Canverisk. The house is quiet, domestic, but one has only to hear the wind in the chimneys to know how near and rough the moor wildness is.
Quite a lot of us that were brought up here are a little wild, says Mrs. Quinn. A little queer.
Believe me, said Cecily to Mrs. Abel now, putting down her cup. She knew something was going to happen.
Mrs. Quinn.
Mrs. Quinn.
Cecily was solemn. The tea was so black and strong that it gave the drinker a knockback almost like spirits. This was the fourth pot Cecily and Mrs. Abel had drunk since the morning, and with it, and her tiredness and shock, Cecily felt what she called out of herself.
I have been turning it over in my mind, said Cecily. Yesterday she was excited.
Mrs. Quinn was.
Yes, and glad.
Glad in a way Cecily had not known her to be glad for years,
though she was always contented, said Cecily. When she walked, she was quick.
Cecily searched for words. I have never known her more alive. And Cecily's eyes filled again. Cecily's big body was worn. Though it was heavy, it had the thin, knotted legs and over-large hands of a woman who has worked too hard. But her black eyes were still young and innocently responsive.
"It was as if somebody was coming," whispered Cecily.
"Do we think her nod her was going to die? That her foresaw it?" asked Mrs. Abel.
"Some folks do, you know. I mind," but Cecily cut her short. "It wasn't dying she was thinking about, it was living. She was at me to spit and polish the house. She did all the flowers. Somebody's coming, I'm sure of it." "But nobody came."
"Except the ones who would come," said Cecily. There were many of them. August was kept busy, frantically barking and running first to one door, then another. He had not learned the wisdom of Bumble, who knew that most comers to China Court were friends. Besides, August's nerves were on edge. Dr. Taft came again, then the vicar, who, though Cecily was strong chapel, was still her good friend. He sent Hoskins the builder, who was also the undertaker, while all day there was a trickle of people to the back door, women carrying a basket or a plate covered with a napkin.
"Just slipped down with a bit of my lardy cake."
"Saffron buns."
"A lion Swiss roll."
"Half a dozen eggs."
"Thought you'd be needing extra with all the family coming."
Most often it was a bunch of flowers.
"Cottage flowers, the only kind I want."
Cecily could hear Mrs. Quinn saying it.
"But don't pick all the Michaelmas daisies," she would have said. "I don't want to spoil the harvest festival."
It was odd that Mrs. Quinn, who has done less in the village than any other lady of China Court, Adza with her soups and visits, or conscientious Anne, or Bella with her Red Cross lectures and workers' adult education courses, should be the one St. Probus loves. Perhaps the first it really accepts. Though Great Uncle MacLeod is village-born, the Eustace Quinns, when they come from Devonshire, are reckoned as foreigners in St. Probus, foreigners from England.
"Well, isn't Cornwall England?" Barbara asks, puzzled.
"But in Cornwall, people speak of going to England as if it were another country, and St. Probus is Cornish, unalloyed, encouraging no outsiders."
"Well, nobody would live here unless they had to," says sharp-tongued Eliza.
"There is nothing here, nothing,"
she cries passionately.
"Only everything," says Damaris, her sister.
The flowers begin to heap up in the tubs Cecily put for them on the larder floor. And in the afternoon, telegrams began to come.
"But no one will be here until tomorrow," she told Mrs. Abel. "Bella and Walter have to come down from Worcestershire. He will be in a fine old taking, having to leave just when apple-picking starts. The others are on holiday in Oban," said Cecily, looking at the telegram.
"That's Scotland, isn't it?"
The second Grace was working in London and could not get away until tomorrow. "They will all bring their husbands. That means getting all the rooms ready," said Cecily. "Just as well Mrs. Quinn did make me have a real clean." Mrs. Abel helped her with the beds. The sheets were linen, but old now and thin. Some of them come with Adza when she marries. Some are turned sides to middle during the war. The blankets were old, too, washed thin, almost cottony, and some of the towels were rubbed through. For years there had not been so many rooms used, and Cecily had to send Groundsel up to the shops for cakes of soap to put in the soap dishes on the old-fashioned marble-topped washing stands. She filled the jugs with clean water.
"And weren't they dusty inside?" she told Mrs. Abel, ashamed.
"He couldn't do all the work of this girt house," said Mrs. Abel.
It was late afternoon when they reached the white room.
"But I have done that," said Cecily.
"It was got ready yesterday, before—"
she broke off, not trusting her voice. The white room, by tradition, belongs to the girls of the family.
"We even have to be bedded two by two," says Eliza.
How I want a room to myself.
When she has one after Anne is gone, Eliza is no longer a girl, but
a cantankerous, secretive old spinster, says Eliza.
After she dies, there are for a long while no girls. Borowis sleeps in the handsome red room where no boy or girl has been allowed before. It is John Henry who has the boy's traditional room, the shabby brown, as he and Borowis are the only two children where all the brood have been. They can inhabit a room each. Ripsy, of course, does not dream of sleeping at China Court, but she is condescendingly allowed to peep into the white room when the boy's cousin, Isabel Loftus Kennedy, comes to stay. With its white and pink dotted wallpaper, white muslin curtains, flowered rugs, and its low mahogany furniture, the white room looks to Ripsy like a girl's bedroom in a book. And when her own daughters, Bella and the eldest Grace, come to sleep in it, she will not have it changed. No man or boy or married woman has ever slept in it. It is kept for girls. And now, when Cecily and Mrs. Abel went in, they saw something that was not there when Cecily cleaned it yesterday, a vase of pink Damascus roses, twin of the one she had put by Mrs. Quinn.
"She put it there," whispered Cecily.
Cecily always knows Mrs. Quinn's rating of people by the flowers she gives them. She gives plenty. No visitor ever leaves China Court without a bouquet. Flowers are always put in Bella's or the Grace's room when any of them comes to visit.
But only the ordinary kinds of roses, says Cecily, or sweet peas, or anemones, or snowdrops. Mrs. Quinn is careful of her pearls.
Once, when Cecily's ill, Mrs. Quinn gives her a bunch of these same roses, and Cecily has known her to take them up to the churchyard for Damaris. But they were for nobody else, thought Cecily. Now, for a moment, she stayed looking at them. Then she pushed Mrs. Abel out and closed the door. The room seemed suddenly private.
"I can put a Grace and her Tom into the night nursery," she said. "Or they can split up and go into the porch room in the yellow. But I don't think they should come in here. Especially not Bella," she added. "No, I won't let Bella and her questions in here."
"Would he like me to stay the night?" asked Mrs. Abel.
But Cecily shook her head.
"Don't bother. I shall sleep."
"Sleep?"
Cecily felt Mrs. Abel's look of surprise. But it was better that Mrs. Abel should disapprove than have hurt feelings.
"No one shall watch by Mrs. Quinn but I, Cecily Morgan."
That was what Cecily wanted to say, but
"I'm sure I shall sleep," she said instead.
And presently, under the eyes, surprised too, of the village, Mrs. Abel went home. Soon dusk settled over China Court. It was late when Peter came from the farm, down through its field to the river, across the bridge and up the valley path. He stopped by the wall to look, as Ripsy stops more than 70 years before. He has been threshing since dawn.
"And two men short on the thresher," said Peter.
It was booked to go on to Glentyre, so that Penbarrow had to finish in one day. Peter's clothes smelled of oil and dust. There was chaff in his hair and down his neck. Its dust was stuck to his sweaty body, and his eyelids were swollen with it. The throbbing noise of the thresher and the worry of its cost seemed locked into his head. He ached with tiredness and such sadness as he had never known for his old friend, Mrs. Quinn.
"I have no father and mother now, thank you," says Peter, when he first meets Mrs. Quinn again, and she talks of Lord and Lady St. Omer. "No relations, thank you, no friends."
But he and Mrs. Quinn grow steadily through all the stages he condemns, friends, then curiously intimate relations, until it is almost,
"Mother and another son," says Mrs. Quinn.
Peter comes up the drive one summer day to try and buy the Famille Rose.
"I used to come here and see you sometimes when we lived at Tremelin," he says.
I remember, says Mrs. Quinn. And sometimes when you didn't see me, says Peter, I was poaching. He has a smile that he has been told is charming. It does not charm Mrs. Quinn.
I remember that, too, she says. You tried to sell me a salmon out of your own father's river. You and that old rogue Jim Neat. How did you get caught up with him?
I liked him better than my father, says Peter.
So did I, says Mrs. Quinn.
She and Borrowis, with John Henry as an uneasy accessory, often poach with Jim Neat, a boy Jim in those days, trespass and poach Lord St. Omer's rivers. Not this Lord St. Omer, the one before, Lord Harry, Mrs. Quinn reminds herself.
And now you want to poach my china, she says aloud.
Yes. Peter tries to be unabashed, but he is working for the kind of firm that makes Mr. Alabaster, of Trescott Alabaster and Grice, valuers and assessors, purse his lips, and Peter does not say it with a zest.
I thought you had some pretty nice things, he says, and I'm down here poaching. I hoped the natives might not know the values.
Including this native, says Mrs. Quinn.
Young scallywag, explodes Walter when he hears, trying to get round an old woman.
But Peter does not get round Mrs. Quinn. She raps out,
We're Cornish. If anyone is done, it won't be us.
I'm Cornish too, says Peter.
Then what are you thinking of?
It is no use thinking, says Peter severely.
Mrs. Quinn is normally not much interested in people, and it is only the severity that makes her look at this young man with more attention.
Why does he fence himself in with these barricades? Asks Mrs. Quinn silently.
And an odd thought comes into her mind, that if her farm, Penbarrow, has been allowed to run down, this young St. Omer is more run down still. Why has Penbarrow come into her mind just at that moment? She does not know. Then, says Mrs. Quinn. Peter's face is more than thin. It is haggard. Surely young people ought not to be haggard? She can see no reason for it. There is no depression now, no war. His fingers are yellow from cigarettes. His skin yellow, too, but yellow-white. Too much fug, too little air, she thinks, and his breath smells of drink. His red hair is dull and broken-ended, while his clothes are worn thin, even frayed. She glances at his cuffs. His shoes are cheap, and with certainty she knows how much he hates them to be that. And again, Penbarrow, with its good soil given over to thistles and nettles, its tumble-down sheds and vanished stock is in her mind.
When you used to come here, you were going to be a farmer. Why weren't you? She demands.
At once there is another look in his eyes. Then it is promptly throttled, thinks Mrs. Quinn, and his voice is as carefully light as before as he says, Why wasn't I? Laziness? Propinquity? All my tribe are in London, haunting the more dubious professions. We are broke, you see. Really broke, even our consciences and our guts.
I'm sorry, says Mrs. Quinn.
Don't be. It's quite peaceful, more. It's miraculous. What do we do for a living?
His voice mocks.
Almost nothing, yet we still live.
Nonsense, says Mrs. Quinn.
There wasn't any money for training, he says quietly. None of us has any brains, and we were brought up to be useless. The old man is wise in his ugly fashion. He has quarreled with us all, so that he is quite justified in keeping what he has for himself. Or perhaps he's keeping it for Harold. Poor old Harold. He's worse off than any of us. One day he will have to wear the family crown, and it's cardboard now, not even made of tin.
Then Peter says, as if in spite of himself,
I did farm a bit at Tremellin on the home farm, but father wouldn't let me keep it to try. Probably he couldn't let me. We were thick in mortgages fallen due like a melodrama. He mocks, and the light voice comes back. I had to let it go. Everything went. He shrugs.
You could have tried somewhere else.
Where? Asks Peter. We left a nice little trail behind us. Bills not paid, repairs not done, cottages falling to pieces, cases against us. Ask your Walter. He will tell you, and he's always right. No one in their senses would trust one of us with a dog kennel, let alone a farm.
No one in their senses, agrees Mrs. Quinn, and she offers him Penbarrow.
Good God in heaven, says Walter when he hears what she has done. Good God!
He is good, I believe that, says Mrs. Quinn. And you know, Walter, I thank him that I am a sinner. At least it prevents me from judging.
Evidently, says Walter, that scallywag in Penbarrow.
Why not? Asks Mrs. Quinn.
Quite apart from being a St. Omer.
He has quarreled with them, says Mrs. Quinn serenely.
There you are. That makes it even more unsuitable. A St. Omer, and he was trying to swindle antiques.
He was never successful. His heart wasn't in it.
Trying to swindle, says Walter firmly, and I'm quite sure he knows nothing at all about farming.
It must be said now that Walter had cause for alarm. It did not seem likely that any young man notoriously lazy and irresponsible, with a town weediness and stamped with all the St. Omer characteristics, the flaming red hair, brown eyes that respected no one, and the casual manners that never failed to nettle Walter, could take over a run-down farm and make it pay.
"Well, I didn't believe it either," said Peter. "It hasn't paid yet, but it will."
And, "How could you die?" he wanted to cry now to Mrs. Quinn. It seemed to him unpardonable.
"I was going to surprise you," said Peter. He had harvested his real crop, built his first hay ricks, and at long last started his herd. "Tonight or tomorrow?"
"Please God, not tonight," said weary Peter.
His first calf would be born. It would be the firstborn, first fruit, and little heifer or bull he had planned to give it to Mrs. Quinn. He looked across the garden to the house. He could see starshine faint on the roof, catch a murmur of life from Cecily's guinea fowls in the tree in the kitchen garden where they roosted at night. But it was only the ghost of a murmur. The dark windows of the house gave their own message. China Court will be sold, thought Peter. He could not imagine Bella or Walter living there, nor their echoes, the three Graces with their Tom, Dick, and Harrys. There would be a sale. Strangers would flood in as they had at Tremellin to handle and pick over, assess furniture, pictures, and china. It would all go. The private things, the flowers, even the cat. Then the house would be sold, though who would buy it he did not know.
People won't live in big houses now. Bella was always saying that. But looking at China Court across the garden, it seemed to Peter exactly fit.
For someone wanting a home, thought Peter.
I would buy it tomorrow, thought Peter, and had to laugh, though it was a hollow-sounding laugh. Buy China Court. He had perhaps 40 pounds in the bank, and with a shock he saw what he had not realized until this moment. He was finished, too. With the house, the farm would be sold. Bella and Walters would certainly not have him as a tenant. The knell that had rung for Mrs. Quinn had rung for them all. China Court, Penbarrow, Peter.
Finished, said Peter, and lifted his hands from the wall. It was then that he saw the lamp. He had not noticed it before. It was so small. Small but steady. It shone in one of the upper rooms, in, and for a moment Peter's heart leapt with shock, in Mrs. Quinn's room. Then he knew the reason. Someone was watching. Watching.
not standing lamenting and dreaming. I never thought of watching, thought Peter, and if he had, it would have seemed to him something remote from himself, old-fashioned, superstitious. But now he knew it was like China Court itself, fitting and faithful. He wondered if he should go in, take turn. It was, of course, Cecily who watched, but like one of Mrs. Quinn's raps and over the knuckles this time, he remembered he was not free. There was, after all, another kind of watching, of keeping faith. That calf might be born tonight. Her calf, thought Peter. For a moment he stayed. Then, absurdly heartened, absurdly because nothing was changed, he swung back down the path. After he had gone, the light shone steadily through the night.
Prime. Iam lucis orto sedire deum precemer supplices. Now daybreak floods the earth with light. Hymn for Prime from Mrs. Quinn's Day Hours. The Nativity. The scene takes place at night, the stable being lit by a single lantern hanging in one corner, the rays of which shine full onto the Virgin and Child. The Virgin is seated on a mound of straw and raises one hand to shade the sleeping child's eyes from the light. Joseph is in a corner preparing a meal. In the shadows at the back of the stable, the heads of three cows are visible. Full border of conventional flowers, pimpernels and fruit, mulberries and ivy leaves, painted in colors and heightened with gold. Figures of stags, hounds, and hares, grotesque archer with the head of a man and the body of a bird shooting at a stag. Miniature facing the opening of Prime, in the Ore Beati Virginia Mariae, from the Hours of Robert Bonifoy. In the early morning, larks sing on the moors. Not many humans hear them. It is too early yet for men to go to work or children to walk across the moor to school or, nowadays, wait for the school bus. Too early for the farm carts or cars starting on their way to the market at Bodmin. Even for the postman's van or riders to the meet. Only the milkers, like Peter, and one or two shepherds at lambing time hear that first fine flush of song, the trilling rise, the wings beating up and up until they fold, and like a plummet, the lark drops onto the grass and heather. Only milkers and shepherds and Damaris and Mrs. Quinn. The villagers do not see Mrs. Quinn go up the street on those early mornings, as they do not, in her day, see Damaris. The cottages are shut fast, every crack sealed that might let in air, but on the way back, the doors are open. Open a half-door to keep the children in. Fires are lit, and lamps and candles, pasties and cans are put ready for the men going out. There is the sound of voices, a slap, a child's cry, or laughing. At 7:30, the quarry hooter goes, and further away, the clay works hooters, and then there is a sound of hobnailed boots hurrying down the road. At 7:30, the village is ready for work, but early as the lark is too early for St. Probus. The village people seldom go on the moor. The most they do is to walk along the road to its edge on Sundays, for anyone to walk up there at dawn and only to hear the birds sing, St. Probus would call plainly, "Mazed," as indeed it disturbs Adza for Damaris and John Henry for Mrs. Quinn. The moor is light first, then the village and hill, and the light comes slowly downwards until it reaches China Court. It grew now in Mrs. Quinn's room, picking out the white sheet, the looking glasses in the wardrobe fronts. The white cloth glimmered on the table, the white marble in the fireplace, and the light caught Cecily's white hair worn in a crown of plaits that had slid a little crooked as she slept. The circle thrown by the lamp was lost as the darkness went. The flame grew pale. Now daybreak floods the earth with light. It is at this time that Mrs. Quinn still wakes, even after a wakeful night, for she sleeps now as the old sleep, lightly as breath. For the last year she has not been able to walk as far as the moor,
and it is now that she has taken to reading the black book of the day hours, moving the green ribbon marker through the week at Lodz. As she moves a peacock feather tip to mark compline of the different days, it is these two of the offices that she chiefly reads. She owes this to Tracy, because Tracy, in her short years at China Court, starts the habit of coming into Mrs. Quinn's bed in the early morning and bringing the other book of hours with her, the velvet-bound one with its borders and paintings. "What's the story?" asks Tracy of each. "What does it say?" And for the first time, Mrs. Quinn realizes this is not simply a quaint picture book, but that the monk or nun who illuminated it with such delicate care was doing it for a purpose. She cannot make out a word of the Gothic script, the old Latin. But in the loneliness after Tracy is gone, she comes back to it again. It seems to bring Tracy close to her. And, one morning, "Do they have books of hours now?" she asks herself. "Modern ones, in translation?" In a moment of inspiration, she writes to the abbey at Dosemary to find out. Day hours, the hours of the day, the little breviary. She is amazed at the lists the nuns send. "Are they all different?" she writes to ask, and the answer comes back. "There are different editions, but they are essentially the same." She buys the day hours as being the simplest name, and when she has succeeded in finding her way about in them, begins her habit of reading them. She grows to value them. The hours seem to thread the day and give it meaning. Like the windows at China Court, they reflect the day. Dawn, sunrise, morning, the passing of noon and afternoon, sunset, evening, dusk, and night until the night is past and day is at hand. Cast off the works of darkness, put on the armor of light, let us walk honestly as in the day, and it is morning. "But is this English?" Bella asks distrustfully after looking at the book. "I mean, does it belong here?" "It is English of Cynewulf and Cadmon, of Sir Gawain and King Arthur, of Alfred and Chaucer, the Canterbury Tales,
and Canterbury Cathedral, and the Pilgrim's Way," Mrs. Quinn would have said,
"as English as it is universal," which is perhaps why she finds it satisfying. Great Uncle MacLeod would have been even more distrustful than Bella. He would have been shocked.
"Popish! A papist book in my house!"
China Court is lightly streaked with religion, no more than that, but its prejudices are strong. Adza and Eustace, temperately Church of England, are upset when Anne becomes chapel.
"Like a villager," says Eliza scathingly,
while Eustace is even more upset when Jared, marrying Lady Patrick, has to agree to their eldest son, Borowis, being christened a Roman Catholic. He is not brought up as one, and there is no trouble when John Henry is born. By then, Lady Patrick has closed her heart and mind to any faith at all. Besides the family Bible and the books of hours, there are in the house prayer books, hymn books, Wesleyan as well as ancient and modern, Christmas carols, a child's pictorial gospel, and a peep of day. In the drawing-room cabinet is an ivory crucifix on the same shelf as bundles of joss sticks and a Chinese god of plenty that the ignorant Quinns always refer to as a Buddha. There is also a real Buddha, a head in green soapstone that the family fondly believes to be jade. Most of them only vaguely connect it with religion, but the peace of its face pervades the room. Cecily had fallen asleep. She had meant to watch, but the constant stream of people, the baking and getting rooms ready, and grief, she would have said, had made her more tired than she knew. "And Mrs. Quinn would want me to sleep if I was tired." Towards dawn she had grown cold and crept out and fetched a blanket to put over her feet and knees. She put one over Mrs. Quinn, too.
"Silly or not, I felt I had to," said Cecily. "I can take it off before they see it."
She could feel under the sheet how Mrs. Quinn had stiffened.
"You are not afraid to stay alone?" Mrs. Abel had asked,
but no more than Mrs. Quinn was Cecily alone. The Quinns have always been good, faithful employers, and they have good, faithful servants, almost always. it could have been said, "There was Anne Sly." Anne Sly is the second housemaid in Lady Patrick's time. Lady Patrick quite genuinely does not notice servants. For her, they are part of the necessary furniture of a house. She would be quite amazed to know that they have feelings, and if she wants a handkerchief or a glass of water in the middle of the night, she rings. But as Anne Sly goes about her work, curiously, Lady Patrick has to look at her, and Anne Sly looks back, her black eyes hard and bold as marbles. Lady Patrick seems to see that look again in Ripsey, though why she should it is hard to say, for Ripsey's eyes are gray-green. Perhaps, to Lady Patrick, they have the same bold interloping look. Anne Sly is well named, but faithfulness is more usual. Polly, for instance, comes as nursemaid to Mary and Eliza, the first two of the brood, and stays until she is nearly 90. She is not Cornish, but no one remembers where she came from, or if she has a family of her own, because she seems part of the Quinns, and no one of them knows, least of all Polly, how much they love and depend upon her. All the brood, Mary, Eliza, Anne, little Eustace, until he dies, Macleod the Second, Jared, and Damaris. Borowis and John Henry love Polly too, but she is not such a power with them.
"And how I dreaded her," says Mrs. Quinn.
She dreads McCann too, when McCann comes to look after Stace.
"My baby is my religion," says McCann,
and Mrs. Quinn does not dare to contradict that "my." McCann leaves when the third and youngest little Grace is 5 years old. Among the servants there is, too, the elegant parlour-maid Pringle, who first forbids Ripsey the house, Pringle, and after her Paget, and long before either, when Adza is first married, the maid who is the first in China Court to be called by her surname instead of the homely Emmy or Patty. "A grand maid," says Adza, trembling, "the parlour-maid, Abbott." Though Abbott is soon shortened to Abby. There is Hester, the upper housemaid, unfairly dismissed, and the little Alice, Tracy's nursemaid, not very much older than Tracy herself. Tracy comes from the village, and many other village girls and boys take service at China Court. "We had knife boys then," says Cecily, "and stable boys and laundry maids. We used to be 7 in the house," she says, "and 2 men and a boy outside." It is nothing, of course, compared to the St. Omers, but it is respectable. Even Eliza has to admit that. There is one foreigner, the Swiss maid, Minna. Mrs. Quinn takes her over from the St. Omers when McCann leaves to wait on the schoolroom, do the children's bedrooms, sew, wash, iron, and speak German with the little girls. Minna never succeeds in getting the children to speak a word of German, and she is most unhappy. She suffers in the long, mild Cornish winter. At night, when she turns her face into her pillow, its stiff white slopes make her think of the mountains round her home where there are hundreds of fir trees hung with frost, and tracks of sleigh runners like railway lines over the snow.
"We have snow, but it seldom lies," says Mrs. Quinn, and she adds, "Our winter is beautiful."
"It is beautiful, but no snow," says Minna. Even in December, the garden has scatterings of flowers that worry her. They seem to deny the winter.
"It is not so to see the flowers in the winter," says Minna. "They should not have came."
But no one understands what she means. That makes her feel more than ever a foreigner. "But does anyone," she asks silently, "even those who have breathed it all their lives, feel at home in this chill, damp, heavy Cornish air?" They do not, to Minna, seem at home. They seem each apart, cold, private, even the children. They are so different, these English children, from any Minna has known. They live apart in rooms of their own. They are dressed in colorless clothes. They have very young pink faces and an elderly aloofness, and they laugh unfeelingly at her halting English. Everyone laughs at that. Even Mrs. Quinn has a fleeting, controlled expression that tells Minna at once she has said something funny.
"You will begin your work tomorrow, Minna."
"Yes, madam.
and I shall give you an extraordinary performance, I can promise you." They all laugh at Minna so kindly, but to live she has to speak, and that does not seem to occur to them. There is someone who does not laugh at her, Groundsel, who is the young gardener handyman. Handyman is a good description of Groundsel. He is handy, and he is a man. He helps with the horses, stokes the boiler, and mends the lawnmower. On his hands there is always dirt or earth or grease, but they are good-looking hands. He is a black Cornishman, very swarthy, with dark and wavy hair. He has never been out of Cornwall in his life, and yet he has sympathy with Minna. From the first day she comes, he looks at her in a special way, and doesn't laugh, says Minna. As the light grew and the birds sang, not the larks but the garden birds, the house seemed to wait for its accustomed stir. When Cecily first comes, at 14, she has to be downstairs before 6 to light the fire for the morning baths. On Wednesday she has to black lead the range, polishing the steel, and every day when she has carried in the coals, she goes down on her hands and knees and scrubs the stones round it. Lily white they had to be, says Cecily, often telling of this. There had been no young kitchen maid to do that for years, and yet the stones still showed whiter than the rest. Now Cecily slept, and nothing stirred. No windows were open except Mrs. Quinn's. The front and back doors were locked. Trill, the kitchen canary, was covered in his cage. Moses, the cat, slept in the kitchen armchair. Bumble was alone in his basket in the hall, because Cecily had prevailed on Groundsel to take August home for the night. "He's driving me mad with his panics," she said. There have always been dogs at China Court. Dreadnought, Eustace's bulldog, Jared's gun dogs, and in the stables, in Lady Patrick's time, two brisk little Jack Russell terriers, often lent to the hunt. Borowis names them Nuts and May. In summer, too, there is often a hound puppy being walked, but August, the big poodle, is like a living nerve in the house. He is called August because he is given to Mrs. Quinn by the girls in August just a year ago. "So that when Bumble goes, there will be another dog with you," they say. Bumble is devoted, very much a dog, but August quivers with intelligence and is as clever as any human with more than human antennae. His coat is black and his eyes are peat brown, the color of deep pools in the moor rivers. When he is clipped, his head looks as if it wore a black peruke, and he has moustaches, while below the fleecy cowboy chaps of his legs his paws are delicate and smooth with long black nails. At first Mrs. Quinn looks at him in dismay.
"But I'm used to spaniels."
"A poodle is a change," say the girls. "But I'm not a change," say those poodle eyes. "I am forever. I am August." It was Moses who lifted his head when he heard the sound of a cat, then the steps on the drive. Bumble was too deaf, too dim and amiable to stir. The steps were so light that they did not wake Cecily, but they were walking certainly. They came up to the front door, and there was a sound of a key being put in the lock and turned, though slowly, as if it were not accustomed to being used. The door opened, and Bumble woke, but, instead of growling, he too lifted his head for a moment, and then his tail thumped as if someone he recognized as belonging to the family had come home. Come home. When one of Macleod II's familial rose bowls or vases is rung, it gives off a sound, clear, like a chime, the ring of true porcelain. So China Court gives off the ring of a house, a true home. That ring is in sight, the first sight of any house that has smoke going up from the chimneys or clothes alive in the wind on the line. In Adza's day, the laundry maids come from the village, and sheets, pillowcases, towels, and huge white tablecloths are hung out, as well as pinafores in dwindling sizes, dresses, shirts, nightgowns, frilly drawers, and socks. It is a long time until Alice slips Tracy's dungarees and shirt on the line, and then when Mrs. Quinn's nightgown, stockings, and vest, and Cecily's, wave there alone. Home, too, is in the sight of curtains opened every morning, drawn at evening, in the light through the window panes, light on polished doorknobs, on the letterbox and knocker. It is in cuttings and seed plots in the garden and in cats. The China Court cats inherit, one after the other, the sunny windowsill outside the morning room. In spring, the bed below it is planted with wallflowers. The cats lie there half-drugged by the heavy sweetness. Home is very much in the smell of a house. At China Court, the smell is always of smoke, peat, and wood smoke, of flowers, polish, wine, and lavender, of wet wool from the outdoor coats, the drab smell of gum boots and galoshes, and earlier, of dubbin rubbed into gaiters, and of gun oil and of paraffin for the lamps. On Mondays, the prevailing smell is soap and water, boiling and steam, on Wednesdays, of baking. That is perhaps the best smell. When the bread oven door is opened, the scent of hot loaves fills all the house. "But I like hot cherry pie best," says Borowis, "for the ring of home is in taste as well. John Henry likes steak and onions. To Ripsy, in the emptiness of her inside, the smell of all food is so entrancing that she cannot choose. On Tuesdays, the smell is of hot linen, sometimes of singeing from ironing, while always there are smaller special smells, the smell of the tortoise-shell tea caddy, of a bowl of dried rose leaves, of whitening from the hearthstones. Sometimes there is a slight smell of cat, for one of them, the black sprite called Cuckoo, prefers not to go outside when it is cold, and she uses the basin in the servant's cloakroom. Home is, too, in touch, feeling the fine grain of wood and the roughness of stone, the smoothness of starched linen, and to Damaris, youngest of the brood, the horrible feel of the flannelette strips that have to be knitted into squares on thick wooden needles for the hospitals. What do the hospitals use them for? She is never told, but she knits, while her sisters, Mary, Eliza, and Anne, more patient and more capable than she, make samplers. Eliza's, as usual, is the best sampler, and one worked by her still hangs in Mrs. Quinn's bedroom. "Give me, O Lord, thy early grace, nor let my soul complain, that the young morning of my days has all been spent in vain." Eliza is 5 years old then, and very pious. The ring of home is, too, in the feel of paper, of firelight warm on fingers, of ivory piano keys and cold house keys, in the softness of a cat's fur stroked, a child's hair brushed, in kisses. But most of all, home is in sound. The sound of bells pealed, of clocks all over the house, from the clock in the hall, a grandfather in a mahogany case, to the French clock with its painted cupid under the glass dome in the drawing-room. The clocks tick and taps run. There is the sound of a twig broom, a besom, sweeping the paths, of a chopper as wood is split for kindling, of the lawnmower on sleepy afternoons, and the rhythmic slap, slap, slap of a horse being groomed. There are dog barks and cat purrs, the sound of rooks and Cecily's guinea fowls. "Horrid, noisy pests," Bella calls them. And always there is the sound of footsteps, running up and down stairs, pacing the terrace, high heels tapping on polished floors or flagstones, the scuffling steps of boys kicking out their boots, and children's steps, and maids. And there are voices from the garden, the dining room, the kitchen, nursery, and stairs, so that it is difficult to tell who is speaking. "It would be nice at Christmas, velvet. The bridesmaids could have small muffs."
12 pounds of tapioca! 12 pounds! It's impossible!"
"A Baptist missionary, not even CMS.
"You walked straight into the lion's den, you little fool."
Ach, yes, I love."
"He is a professional charmer." "That's a rare book. Touch it carefully."
"No more idea than a babe unborn." "Mother says it's twaddle."
"He can't sell that. It was MacLeod's."
"Who said you could play here?"
Now the new light steps ceased, as if somebody stood in the hall and listened. There was a long pause, then lightly they ran up the stairs, crossed the landing, and knocked at Mrs. Quinn's door. That soft knock woke Cecily. Half asleep, she mumbled, "Come in." Then, like a dog on guard, in a flash, she was wide awake. "There is no one in the house, no one," Cecily remembered, and all Mrs. Abel's tales woke in her mind. No one could get in. No one had the key. Her legs were suddenly cold, and her hands cold, too, as they gripped the chair. Her hair felt as if it crept on her scalp. The soft knock came again, but Cecily's throat was dry, and she could not speak. She could only give a small, choked croak. The handle turned, and slowly the door opened. There was another pause. Then startled, frightened young eyes met hers. They looked, and Cecily half rose from her chair. "So that was who," began Cecily. "So that, it is, isn't it?" She was still not certain. "Isn't it?" Then, "It is," more positively, and, "Tracy," cried Cecily. "Tracy!"
So now we have met Peter pretty well, I think, and we have seen why Mrs. Quinn felt like taking a chance on him, especially after all of Walter's bad ideas of the progressive farmers that we saw in the first section of Lauds. And we know that in the next section we'll meet Tracy. Both of these are major players in the current history of the house as it goes forward. But I also like the way that Mrs. Quinn thought of Peter in terms of the farm, the piece of land that he would be connected to. It made me think of the way that China Court is really the anchor for all of the stories that we're hearing. And so we get more about the character of the house here as if it were a character, the sounds, the smells, the sense of touch of what's in the house, so that we can really almost feel ourselves to be there. I know it seems to be a slow start, but it makes me think of the concreteness of it all, perhaps, how people who love China Court and the surroundings are anchored very solidly to the house, to the land. And that's something that we've lost a lot of today, and I think that's a little bit of what we're getting the feeling for in this book. Everybody's wanting to be free of things, as they said in the first section, and Mrs. Quinn doesn't want to be free. Peter doesn't want to be free. He's willing to sacrifice and work very hard, as we can see, in order to have an existence that's very tied to the land. So I think it will be interesting to see how that theme goes on. I also had forgotten to mention before, there, Darwin Catholic wrote and said that he was having a lot of trouble sorting the characters out just from listening, and he thought that seeing them visually would help, and I do agree. But I have to say that even reading it, everything is so intertwined. For a while, you're just kind of floating along, taking on faith that you will learn more about Damaris and Eliza and some of the characters who make key points in the little sections where their voices speak up. There is a family tree in the end papers, and I really apologize that I forgot about it. Honestly, I never looked at it when I read the book, and I just learned to sort it out from the stories, but I will definitely scan that in and put it in the notes so that people can look at it if they would like to. Something else I forgot to mention is that when the book says someone is chapel, it took me a while to figure it out, but that means they're Catholic, Roman Catholic. So that's what Great Uncle MacLeod is objecting to when Anne becomes chapel. I think they refer to it in this chapter. And I want to thank, especially on this one, Melanie Bettinelli, who helped me by writing out the Latin pronunciation for me. I am sure I mangled it even with her help, and that is purely my fault, nothing to do with her. It is very helpful to have a lot of Catholic friends who know Latin and how you pronounce it, because I do not have a feel for it at all. I did want to include it because it is definitely part of this book. But I'm sure I'm just tearing it to little shreds. I also wanted to mention that for the first time, I will be playing a promo after this podcast. You may recall in previous episodes, I have mentioned Decoder Ring Theater as a podcast pick, and also I have mentioned SFF Audio
as a podcast pick, even though they're not a podcast, but they are a wonderful resource for finding things to listen to. And in a wonderful twist of fate, SFF Audio actually has a promo that has been done by Decoder Ring Theater. So I will be playing that at the end of the podcast. I am going to get this ready to go, and I'm going to start getting ready for Thanksgiving. The good thing is, since it's a long weekend, I'll have time to keep up, get back on schedule, or so I think. I hope everybody has a very good Thanksgiving, or if you're from Canada or England or some of those other places where you're not having Thanksgiving, I hope you have a wonderful rest of the week and a great weekend. You can find a blog for this podcast at hcforgottenclassics.blogspot.com, where I am delighted to read any and all comments that are left. You can also email me. My email is in the sidebar there. Also, if you want to leave comments on the podcast in general at iTunes or Podcast Alley, that also would be most welcome. Thanks for coming by, and I'll talk to you again soon.
SFFAudio.com, the sound of tomorrow. Explore the limitless worlds of the imagination with SFFAudio.com. Reviews and features, audiobooks, online audio, full cast audio drama and radio theater. The ultimate source for news from the world of science fiction and fantasy audio, brought to you by the most trusted team in the business. SFFAudio.com, the future never sounded so good.